I've known John for a number of years, ever since I got clean the first time a few years ago. I've watched this man go through some situations in his life that I've been privileged to not have to go through in my recovery. And I've seen him come through it gracefully and grow through it. With no further ado, I'd like to introduce John A. from Chicago.
I'm an addict. My name's John. Let me get comfortable. Let me get comfortable and feel a part of this fellowship. I want to thank the committee for asking me to share tonight. You know, I had some difficulty with that. And once again, I learned some more about our second tradition and what a group conscience is. And that sometimes my thinking is not spiritual in nature. And I have to trust the fact of the people that made the decision that says, I have something to give, to stand up here and give it. One of the things that I know is Narcotics Anonymous has given me the privilege to have dignity today. It's given me the privilege to have honesty today. It's given me the privilege to be visible and vulnerable in front of you. I'm thankful. Thankful and grateful to be a part of. Part of what happened, and I want to do this, and I hope this this works. And, you know, hope was the first spiritual principle that I learned about when I came to Narcotics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you about the last 3.5 days that I used. The last 3.5 days was one of those attempts prior to that where I was trying to control my disease and doing simple abstinence without the fellowship in Narcotics Anonymous. In that 3.5 days, probably the most horrendous experience of my life happened. I was in a court system that said I was a threat to myself and a threat to the community. I knew about court systems because part of my story is I was a criminal addict. But that was the first time that I couldn't blame it on anyone else. You know, our basic text talks about blaming as a symptom of our disease. And I couldn't do that. And, you know, prior to that, I had done many, many things to find recovery. But again, it was my will against God's will. The ends were always the same. You know, the ends were always the 3.5 day runs. I created a lot of legal wreckage during that time. And I'll never forget standing up there in that court system. See, they wouldn't detox me at the local hospital. Because what would happen when I went to that local hospital, because I'd been detoxed a number of times, and I just learned 2 years ago that in 1980, I had 2 heart attacks from one of those withdrawal times. I used real hard, trying to kill the pain. But when I was in that jailhouse, because that's the only place they could keep me from not hurting myself, I said, how am I going to get out of this? How am I going to get out of this? At that time, I was on parole and probation for 5 felonies. And you know the wonderful thing about recovery is the only time you know I'm a criminal addict today is when I tell you. Yeah, there's a few friends of mine that we've done some institution work. And yeah, we don't have to be criminals anymore, especially in recovery. You know, we can carry ourselves with some dignity and pride and leave the past in the past and live for today. But I went in front of that court, you know, and I was the kind of addict that I'm too smart. My thinking gets me continuously in trouble. And having been in the criminal justice system since 1971, I knew a little bit about their procedures, and I knew a little bit about law books. And toxic as I was still able to beat that involuntary commitment. Superior Court judge at that time recessed the hearing, took my parole officer, took the community alcohol and drug officer, took the county mental health officer, and had a recess in their session in his chambers. He came back out and he said, "Mr. Abrahamson, I'm going to send you to prison. You're not willing to seek help." And at that time I said, "I'll go." Because I thought I was one of those addicts that couldn't recover. I had been trying and trying and trying. The one piece I didn't have was I didn't have Narcotics Anonymous as we know it today. I went to a treatment center that wasn't a treatment center. It was a semi-classical mental institution. It had barred walls, barred windows, locked doors. It was on a mental institution ground in Cedar Rowley, Washington. They used to march us over to the chow hall every three times a day. And the people that were in the mental institution used to either go right before or right behind us. I literally lived in fear those first 2 months that I was there, that I wouldn't step over that thin line and be placed over in the mental institution. Because I had to start taking a look at what my addiction was like, the insane behavior and the things and the harm that I'd done to others, and the utter hopelessness that I had experienced through 22 years of active addiction. I had to get some hope. I had to get some hope at that treatment center. I had to do something different. And probably one of the biggest things I did different in that first week was I made a commitment to Narcotics Anonymous, and I made a commitment not to use today. And that has given me what has been given to me since I've been clean 8 years and 7 months ago. I have a picture up here in the podium of the last day that I used when they booked me into that county jail. The friends of mine, and there's many of them in this room, have seen that. You know, one of the ways that you know I'm still an addict today is like I got this Coke here, and I also got one stashed under the table because one was never enough. You know, yeah, I never did do one thing at one time. While I was in that treatment center, one of the things that happened was they had a meeting in Mount Vernon, Washington, a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. As a hope to die dope thing. Took a lot of pride in that. You know, I had an opportunity about 4 years ago to speak at a small convention that we have up in Washington, and 27 years later, there I was speaking about recovery, and 27 years prior to that was when I used my first two drugs, not two blocks away. And that's some of the spiritual awakenings that come from this program, and I've had many by staying open to God and new people. But I was in that treatment center, and I made that commitment to go to Narcotics Anonymous, and I had to find hope somewhere. I had to find hope. I had to become willing. You know, they talk about we're only as sick as the secrets we keep. And I had a lot of secrets. I had done a lot of harm to a lot of people. And I used this excuse, well, according to the legal limits, I can't talk about that because I might be convicted. Yeah. What I was afraid of, if you knew everything that I had done, you would have nothing to do with me. See, I hadn't learned about what this disease of addiction is at that time. I thought I was responsible. I was thrilled to death when we got our basic text, and I was writing the Victoria Ferry when I got that first copy, and it said in there, we're not responsible for our addiction. We're not responsible for our disease, but we are responsible for our recovery. So I get further reinforcement about this commitment to work a program of recovery. I knew how to use. I knew how to be a drug addict. Yeah, I did that well. If you wanted to get loaded, we got loaded and we stayed loaded. Yeah. I used to take a lot of pride that I was different than most of them other drug addicts because of quantities and all of this. And one of the things that happens is if I start getting drug specific about my disease, I set myself apart from about half you people, maybe 70%. So I talk about being an addict, so I am a part of. And that's real important for me because, see, I never fit. I was an only child, and I grew up very, very, very lonely. I had no one to share with. And that's why when I used that first drug in 1959, those first two drugs, I got that sense of wholeness. I got that sense of being equal to peers. I got that sense that, yeah, I'm okay, because it covered up that void that I have been feeling. But I came to Narcotics Anonymous, and people just loved me. They just loved me. And there's a man sitting in this room that knew me when I was in that institution. You know? How important it was. And part of what, you know, I mean, God really works in my life. Because they let me go out to that NA meeting. You were supposed to have all these little step things and stuff, you know? But I got to go right from the beginning. And I got that reinforcement in there about what this fellowship is. I can remember crying and crying and crying. I had a sponsor that said in the beginning, I wish I could keep you sick. Because when you're sick, you're visible and vulnerable and you want to work to get well. But once you get well, what happens is you get recovered. Yeah. And that's part of that commitment I made in the beginning, was to be a part of the steps, not just talk about them. To live the steps, not just parrot them. I was 5 years clean, and, you know, God, we got basic texts coming out of our ears, you know, from the first edition to the other one, and to the other one, and to the other one, and now finally we got one we can't change for a few years, thank God, because I got 19 of them, you know. Yeah. But in How It Works, there's some questions in there that are in that chapter, and I went, my God, that is what this fellowship is about. One of those questions in there, it says, do we understand we have no real control over drugs? And that's one of the things that happened when I did that first written first step was, I saw how I used drug A, would switch to drug B, would switch to drug C, and switch all around. You know, I saw that just simple abstinence was not going to do it because the ends were always the same. I went back and used my drugs of choice. So I had no control. One of those other questions, and I love this one because it says, have we really failed as a drug user? And God, when I was 16 years old, I wanted to be a dope fiend, you know? I did, because there was a lot of pride in that. You know, a dope fiend was somebody. And I failed. I had literally failed. Because they didn't work, and they hadn't worked for many, many years, and that first step proved that. It says, the jails and institutions take over the management of our lives at different times. You know, one of the things that I did when I first came around Narcotics Anonymous was I like to call it these little sergeant stripes. I had to prove to you that I was a drug addict. And one of the things I used to say was, you know, well, I've had 27 felony arrests and 7 felony convictions. I spent 3.5 years in the institution. That tells you how successful I was as a drug addict. Yeah. Shows you how slick I was. Yeah. Probably the biggest thing, again, that really helped me bottom out in my addiction is losing that mental capacity to make rational decisions. I understood that second step even though I had not worked it yet. I worked it in that first step, taking a look at the things that have happened with my drug use. One of the things that I liked in there was another question. It says, do we know that our addiction changes us into someone we didn't want to be dishonest, deceitful, self-willed people at odds with ourselves and our fellow man. I didn't fit. I knew my whole life was a lie. I knew my whole life was a lie. My biggest fear in early recovery, and I want to do something about early recovery because I hear these people talking about this early recovery stuff. I figure I'm out of early recovery when I've used as many days as I did in active addiction. Yeah. So when I get 22 years clean, I can say, well, I might be out of early recovery yet. I don't know, you know. Yeah, what is this? Yeah, I'm in recovery. Now, there ain't no early, middle, or late that's back to having sergeant's stripes again, you know. Let me be different and better than you. Yeah. Probably some of the things that happened in my addiction was in 1977, I backed a truck up to my mother's house, and I took everything that I could out of there. At that time, I was again in legal problems, and I was an escaped felon from this state for a number of years. I ended up in Coos Bay, Oregon. And there's a, you know, I think part of me is privileged because there's only two people from my active addiction that are in recovery. Yeah. And what I'm talking about is the survivors. There's a whole bunch. There's felony institutions, and there's many that are done. I ended up in Coos Bay, Oregon. And I had to stop living the lie because I felt so much shame about what I did to my mother, what I did to my stepfather. You know, our basic text talks about we reached, our living skills reached an animal-like level. I know what that means. And I think we all share that. I could live that animal-like level in a red lion. Yeah. I could reach that animal-like level running 5 stores in San Francisco. You know, I was always a good hustler. I knew how to talk well. And that's probably one of the things that got me in trouble the most, you know, because I could slick my way out of anything. I used to say I could always cry on command, especially when I was standing in front of a Superior Court judge. Yeah. Some of the things that got me clean, some of the things in my first step were invaluable. Wasn't the 27 felony arrests, wasn't the 7 convictions, wasn't the 3.5 years in the institute. It was having my daughter, when she was 3.5 years old, walk into the bathroom and see me shooting dope and seeing the utter terror on that little girl's face. I did not see that little girl because I left and fled because I couldn't stand the pain, and I couldn't stand the responsibility. I didn't see that little girl until 3.5 years ago. And she called me when I was living in Portland here, and she says, is this John so-and-so? And I go, yes. And she says, my name's Lori. I'm your daughter. I want to see you. You know, the only reason she wanted to see me was because I was clean. She said, if you were still a using addict, I would have nothing to do with you. So I met her up in Tacoma, and we spent 4 hours in a park. And we came away from there with some healing. I was able to tell her what happened to her mother when I was with that wonderful woman. And tell her what happened to my life. And as we walked away, she says, you know, I would have left here 5 minutes after we started, but she told the same story my mom did. Yeah. I got a phone call a year later, though. And this is the disease that keeps on giving. Yeah. Yeah. My daughter is in active addiction. And she wrote a bunch of checks up in Tacoma. Her mother called me and said, what can I do? And I says, well, I'll pick up the checks and let's get her prosecuted. Because the quicker she can hit a bottom, maybe she'll find Narcotics Anonymous. I pray for her. You know. Because I know there's women around today that will be there for her when she comes to her meeting. Yeah. And the one, you know, and I can have the faith that she will be at a meeting one day because she knows how her father got clean through Narcotics Anonymous. You know, that void that happens when we complete a first step, and I think those of you that have done a written first step can't have experienced that same void, that utter despair of, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it anymore. I understand that one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. I have to surrender. I had to start believing in something. And in that beginning, I believed in that Mount Vernon meeting that I belonged to. I believed in the Michael, and I believed in the other couple guys that were around there, because they were drug addicts just like me, and they were clean. And they were happy. And they had this sense of camaraderie, you know. And we see it out here in our hallways of men loving men, that glow that goes on, women loving women. Yeah. So I started doing a second step, and I did that. And I went on to the third. And one of the things that I believed in about our third step is, it only says a decision. We made a decision. I believe my spiritual growth and spiritual development has came through my 11th step. Yeah. I don't do a third step prayer expecting 11th step results. Yeah. I do 11th step work. Yeah. The third step gave me permission to believe in a higher power. I couldn't say God the first 2 years I was in recovery. I had trouble saying higher power. After 2 years, I started saying God because I'm pretty lazy. You know? Yeah, there's parts of me that are pretty lazy. And I know it's like my name is spelled J-O-N. Well, it ain't J-O-N. It's J-O-H-N. But this drug addict thinking says, if you leave that letter out, you're going to save millions of letters, and you can write a book one of these days. You know? Yeah. So, it just sounds like you guys think like I do. But I made that decision to start believing and start trusting. And I got enough faith and I got enough support to go on and do my first written four step. I'll never forget that man that did my fifth step with me. And it was an interesting story. The first man I picked to do my four step, see, by this time, they're starting to let me out a little bit more out of this mental institution. And, you know, they're showing, I'm starting to look like I'm tracking. You know, I can count to three, and I'm not bouncing up and off the walls. And so they said, yeah, it'll be a good idea if you go with your sponsor and do your fifth step. And so I had this sponsor, and he says, we're going to do your fifth step on the way to Whidbey Island in the car while he's driving 65 miles an hour. It didn't feel right. You know, it didn't feel right. I knew I maybe need to look for someone else. And I did pick another man. And that man was so kind and so loving and so affirming to me, because I shared with him things that have alienated me for years. I shared with him some guilt, and I shared with him some shame that allowed me to go on with my recovery. And that's what my first, fourth, and fifth step did. It allowed me to go on and have some sense of dignity where I could walk down the street and feel like maybe I got a chance. I was 9 months clean before I really understood that if I worked this program one day at a time, stayed in the middle of Narcotics Anonymous, that I had a chance to recover. And I'll never forget that day in Port Angeles, Washington, overlooking the harbor and seeing Victoria. I knew I was alive, and that was another spiritual awakening. Because I became more willing to believe and do the footwork. I came into the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous with a wonderful woman. God bless her. We came together in simple abstinence. We started getting loaded together. We went back together after I got out of the mental institution in Port Angeles, and she started using together. She started using again, and I had to leave her. And that is probably one of the toughest things that ever happened to me. I'm 8.5 months clean. I'm suicidal. I knew I couldn't use a drug to kill the pain. And it forced me to sit in meetings and sit in meetings and sit in meetings and cry and cry and cry. It forced me to call my sponsor and said, I need to sleep on your couch because I want to die. And that's okay. It's okay. I pray for that woman. I ran into her about 5 years ago. And at that time, she was still using. I had a lot of pain and sorrow for her. Because some of us don't get it, you guys. Some of us come into this fellowship
and say, I'm going to use it one more time, and don't get back. Don't get back. Yeah. So I'm up in Port Angeles, Washington, and I had this white book, you know, because that's what Narcotics Anonymous was this white book. And I had some people in Mount Vernon that were helping some people in Whidbey Island, and we started forming meetings of Narcotics Anonymous. One of the things that happened with that got me real involved. You know, I got into service work real quick, and my motives were, I want to save my butt. Yeah, I want to save my butt. So I'm going to be a part of meetings. I'm going to go to events. And back in 82, when we had events, it was like maybe once or twice a year. You know, what we have now in this fellowship, I mean, every weekend there is something. Every weekend there is something. So I got real involved, and one of the things that happens is I suffer from arrogance. You know, that's part of my addiction. And so I got recovered at about 11 months. And I went through that recovered stage for about 3 years. You know, the recovered stage where I could quote once we got the basic text, verbatim. You know, could stand up there and recite. And that's all I talked about was the basic text. I never talked about me. I also stopped working the steps and took this spiritual sabbatical, as I called it, because after all, I had done my first five. Well, at 18 months, I had these character defects starting to drip off my arms. And some of you know about character defects dripping off your arms. I had three. Yeah. That's going to change later on in my recovery. Arrogance, guilt, and fear. You know, and I'll never forget, I went down to Oregon. I met with a man that had some time, and I says, how do you work on arrogance, guilt, and fear? He says, keep coming back, and he just walked away. That was my answer. I didn't have to do steps 6 and 7. You know, I made a list of people that I had harmed in the beginning. And what I put on that list was people that I had to clean up things about. It says when you do an 8-step, don't think about working a 9-step. But I had to take a look at people because I had to not duck and dodge, not be a runner. You know, I had to get some permanency. One of those people that I had to make some amends to was my mom. And God bless her. I mean, she was wonderful. That woman was always consistent with me. She always loved me. That was one of the things that she did when I got put in that mental institution the last time. She says, don't come back if you're not clean. I can't stand the pain anymore. And she was part of my bottom. But my mom was the kind of person that just says, well, you don't have to make amends to me. What's in the past is past. And I said, Mom, I can't do that. I ripped you off in 77 and blah, 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 blah. And she wouldn't hear it. So my mom lived at the beach, and we used to go walking on the beach. And so I asked her to walk out to the point. Well, the point was 2.5 miles. We walked all the way out there, and once I turned around to start going back, I did my amends with my mother, and thank God for that. I did them for me. I didn't do them for her. Because what I had to do for me at that time, because she'd forgiven me, I needed to forgive myself so I could look her in the eye. I needed to be able to call her out of a sense of love rather than a sense of guilt. So I did some 8th and 9th step work, and I was on my merry way. And one of the things that happened in those first few years were a sponsor that says, right, 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 right. Every sponsor I've ever had, it says, right, 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 you know. God, if you ever got me a computer, I'd just be a killer on right, right, right. But what I did for the first 3.5 years of recovery was I wrote down what I did each day to stay clean. Because it was real important for me to work a program of recovery. Because I got well. And if I didn't do the things that helped me stay clean, I was afraid that I would die. Part of my fear came from, you know, as I said, when I separated from Jeanette, was that I would go crazy, or I would commit suicide. Those were my first two options before drug use. And what I found out of 3.5 years of doing those daily disciplines, was the more things I did for my recovery each day, the better the little self-report was at the bottom. And I learned a lot about that. And one of the things that came out of that first 3.5 years, they are spontaneous now. When I wake up in the morning, I know what my disciplines are. I know what they are through the day. And thank God for that support. Now, again, I know how to use drugs. I didn't know how to stay clean. At 3 years, I had a man. I was at a thing in Victoria, British Columbia. And I was a little spiritual giant, you know, beside this being this recovered addict. I also had 12 relationships the first 3 years of my recovery. Yeah. I also did a first step on recovery wreckage. Yeah. That's a nice concept because, yeah, it's there. But I'll never forget Bob when he said, "Man, if we opened up your head, you'd have 1,000 vaginas sitting there chatting at you." Yeah. It was real sad. Those of you that are laughing understand what I used to think. Yeah. Because I always wanted to be somebody. You know, always wanted to be somebody, and I would... We have a sentence in our basic text about social acceptability does not equal recovery. And I understand that, and I finally really understood it at about 7.5 years clean. But I had to start doing something different. I have a sign that's been in my, it's been in my workplace, it's been in my, house. In fact, I put it in a more, frequent place that I travel through the house here recently that says, if you always do what you've always done, you always get what you've always gotten. Yeah. I always started relationships in the middle. I always started them in the end. I didn't know anything about starting them in the beginning. You know, probably one of the biggest things that has happened from Narcotics Anonymous was, yeah, I had 12 relationships the first 3 years. I can run into each one of those women, and there's no amends to make. This program did give me that. The privilege to clear up the wreckage of today. Some of them I haven't been able to clean up for a while, but I have been able to clean them up. So I had to start doing something different. That 12th relationship was a woman that I married. I thought this was the one. I thought that we had started a friendship, but again, we started it right in the middle. 2 months after we were married, or a month before we got married, she found out she was pregnant. I was a 40-year-old, excuse me, a 40-year-old addict, and I thought I was sterile. You know? Because the last time I'd had a little children was when I was back in a youngster. But I wasn't anymore, and that blew my socks off. And I'm sharing that tonight. Of any of you men out there or any of you women that feel like you haven't been able to conceive a child, watch out if you stay around here long enough and don't use precaution. Yeah. But one of the things that happened with Valerie was, yes, we conceived a child together, and that child died. Before it was born. At the same time, I had a friend with 11.5 years of abstinence. We worked at a the local college together. We went home from a Thursday night class, and he hung himself. So between Valerie and Ron, I was in major grief. Major grief. And didn't know anything about grief. At that time, I went into my workplace and said, I need to go to treatment. I can't make it anymore. I need to go to treatment. They called a bunch of people in Narcotics Anonymous up in Port Angeles, and they came in and said, when are you going to stop? Feel the pain. Let us love you, and you will be okay. And I did that. I did that. It's been real hard for me to let you people love me. It's been real hard for me to let you support me. But I... So in 7 months period, I got a divorce from Valerie. It was ugly. It was ugly. Those of us that have had divorces know what ugly divorces are like. It is ugly. Again, another one of those times where I didn't know if I was going to live. Because I figured, God, at 3.5 years recovery, I should be okay. I should be okay. You know, it was like, I always said, when I have 5 years clean, I'm going to be somebody. You know, back to them sergeant stripes again. I'm going to be somebody. And the sad part was, I was somebody each one of those days I worked towards 5 years. Yeah. You people make me somebody each day that I'm with you. I did a lot of work. I did a lot of work on relationships and met a woman, and we learned how to become friends. We did the right things. We did the right things. I'll never forget probably the first 4 months that we were friends. And that was a nice time too, because when I told her when we first started the friendship, I want to be your friend. And she went, right. Yeah, you're just like all these other guys. And I go, no, really, I want to be your friend. So she kept me out for about a month and figured out I did want to be her friend. Yeah, I didn't want to start this relationship on illegitimate sex. Yeah, I didn't want to find out a month later that we had nothing in common. Yeah. So we worked real hard. And I always, she lived in Walla Walla, I worked in Portland here. I had this little sports car. Yeah, I had this little sports car, and it was every Thursday night, Walla Walla, vroom. You know, every Sunday night, Portland, vroom. Yeah, I did something like 22,000 miles in 7 months. Yeah. But see, I didn't see the obsession. I didn't see the compulsion. Yeah, I didn't see that, because we were doing friends stuff. No, man. Yeah, I was fixing big time. Yeah. I married that woman. Yeah. Yeah. That was my third marriage. I had 4 years clean. Faye had 18 months. And so, in the meantime, I'm being this service worker ranger. You know? You guys that have got 14, 15 service positions? It's a wonderful way not to work the steps. Yeah, you get to be authorities on the traditions. You can be killers in RSCs and area circus. You bet. You bet. But you don't work the steps, see? At least I didn't. I'm not talking about you. Let me talk about my recovery, because that's what God's given me the opportunity to do tonight. So I used peers for sponsors. I stopped having a working relationship with a sponsor, a formal sponsor relationship, from 3 years to a little over 5 years. At 5 years, I started looking around and said, my God, people aren't staying. Where are they going? I haven't been working the steps. Yeah, I hadn't been working the steps. And what I mean by working the steps is, again, written step work. I work the steps each day that I'm clean. a mental, emotional, and spiritual process. Sometimes it's physical when I talk to another addict or another addict talks to me, or I go to my little home group and hang out. So I decided to get a sponsor. And, you know, one of the things that happens, and there's not too many people with time around. And God, I hate that word time. It's almost like a dirty word because it makes you different. But I wanted somebody that had something I wanted. And I've known this man for a number of years. So I asked him to be my sponsor because I was afraid. And he says, "Well, John, have you ever did a written sixth step?" And I go, "No." He says, "Well, I'm doing one, so you might as well do one too." You know? So he told me to write down 18 character defects and get back in touch with him. And I went, "Oh, sure, I can write down 18 character defects." And I got off the phone and I probably can make amends to the man tonight because I said some bad things about him. You know? And he's sitting in this room, too. Who does he think I am? 18 defects. I got this recovery program. Well, I met with him shortly after that, and I ended up with more than 18 character defects. One of the things that I suffer from is ignorance. Ignorance where I think I know the answer when I really don't. And so I looked up each one of those defects and I wrote one on each page what the definition was. And I learned so much from that process. There was one of the things that really touched me in our sixth step, and it says, "How sincerely we work this step will be proportionate to our desire to change." I love that. And another part that was there, it says, "When we see how our defects exist in our life and accept them, we can let go of them and get on with our new way of life." And so what I did, you know, he gave me direction. And of course, I felt I was a little bit different. I wasn't going to do it the way he did it. I was going to do it better. Yeah. But he told me I could only write one page. And I'm one of these guys that can write novels. I can write novels. But he says, "One page per defect." So I started what is called the Defect of the Week Club. And I'll guarantee you, if you start looking at arrogance for 7 days, you'll want to throw up. If you start looking at inadequacy for 7 days, you not only want to throw up over it, but you got arrogance tagging along, see? Yeah. One of the things I did in that written sixth step was I wrote about how that defect was in my childhood, how it was in active addiction, and how it was in recovery. And I wrote what the price tag was for me hanging on to that. And that gave me a newfound freedom. I think I ended up with 30-some defects. It was a real hard time. It was probably one of the toughest steps I had worked in my life up until that time. I went and I got to speak at a winter's thing up north, and I called my sponsor to tell him I'm done. I want to go over it with you and get on with the seventh step. I've been on this thing for a year. My God, I don't want to have this be the sixth step from hell and be in my 11th year of recovery still doing the sixth step. And I called him and he wasn't home, and I talked to his wife. And I said, "Well, I'm going to put it in an envelope and put his name on it and give it to God and him because I can't hang on to it no more." I was able to speak at that small convention, and I had a lot of fear at that time of what, you know, because I really wanted to be good enough and carry a good message of recovery. So I carried it up to the podium. And if I blew it, I was going to start reading my sixth step to those 600 people. Yeah. I threatened to bring the fourth step that I'm working on right now, but I know better. Yeah, I do my fourth step with my sponsor, not here in a meeting. So we did a seventh step. He told me how to do a seventh step. And you know, one of the things, and this was another spiritual awakening, because when I became ready and knew the impact of those defects, like with arrogance, when I let go of arrogance, I gained humility. When I let go of fear, I gained faith. When I let go of dishonesty, I gained conformity. And I'll never forget when he said that one to him because I said the F word to him. And I don't do that to people. Basic text. I used to hang on to this because, see, it made me different. It made me different. It gave me those sergeant stripes. As with our second edition, our third, you know, all of our editions, I used to always hang on to an older one so I could say, I got more time, you know. Yeah, look at me. I think when I did that sixth step and gained a new understanding of conformity was when I started carrying our fifth edition around. Yeah. So it was important for me to bring this up here tonight because, my God, I don't want to be different. I want to be loved. One of the things that happened after I did that, he told me when we talked about all the spiritual principles I would have if I let go of my defects, and he told me to go do this. I looked at it as humiliation process of letting go of my defects. And I was still stuck in them. And it took me a while before I would let go of them, before I would humbly ask God to remove them. But he also gave me another assignment. It's time to do an eighth step, John, because he was doing one. You know? Yeah. I don't know about that, you know? Yeah. One of the things that has happened in my step work is I have done prayers for each step, and I do that with people that I sponsor. We do a four-step prayer, we do a six-step prayer, we do a seven-step prayer, we do an eight-step prayer. Because I learned from that third step of making that decision and searching for God's strength for me to write when I need to so I can continue this journey. That has been a part for many years of writing prayers specific to my steps. So he asked me to do an eight step and he left me off in the dust again. And see, the man lives miles and miles and miles and miles away from me. Not that many. Yeah. Phone's real heavy. We understand that. And I started writing that eighth step. And he says, write it as if you'd never done one. Because it was just sort of like the sixth step. You know, I wanted to say, well, about 18 months I had three. And Harry told me to just keep coming back. You know. So I wanted to not do the footwork again. It's incredible about how our disease stays with us. Our disease says, don't get well. I know I'm in my disease when I say I'm different. So he told me to do one like I never did one before. And I started writing. Started writing. And I did page after page after page after page of people that I had hurt. I put down a place if I couldn't remember the person's name. I had so much shame. So much shame. I came to a convention here a couple of years ago in Pacific Northwest and felt like I didn't belong. That if anybody saw my eighth step, they would literally say, no, you are a phony. You don't belong in Narcotics Anonymous. You are too sick. Look at what you have done. And I had a real difficult time. I had made some amends. That is part of what the journey has done. I have had an opportunity since I did that eighth step and went on to a ninth step to do more amends. I still have amends. But probably one of the biggest gifts of this fellowship is I haven't had to add people to that list except Joe T. And some of you know Joe T. Joe came up and spoke in Olympia and I taped him and said, I'll send you the tape. Well, I just gave it to him tonight and it has been 23 months and 2 weeks later Yeah, yeah. Thank God I can scratch him off his off my list. But it's that kind of wreckage that makes me avoid him. It's that kind of wreckage that keeps me in guilt. It's that kind of wreckage that reinforces my shame. So, part of the amends that I still need to make, part of what I, again, know how powerful my disease is, I got a bad conduct discharge from the service in 1963. And I've never turned that around. I was an addict, doing drugs, and did the things that we do when we do drugs, and they kicked me out. I've never turned that around, and I've always been a second-class citizen with that. The other thing that happened is when I got my first two major felonies, they took my civil rights away. And I haven't sought the footwork to get them restored yet. Every year when, you know, when people vote, normal people vote. Some of you guys even vote, not me. I've never voted in my life. And I need to turn that around because I am no longer a second-class citizen. Yeah. When I spoke at that convention 4 years ago, one of the questions that I didn't do when I started doing those questions from It Works is, it says, are you sure you want to stop using? And what that sentence meant to me was about reservations. I had two reservations when I came to Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't know it at the time. One of those reservations was, if the Department of Corrections ever cut me loose, I could use again. Because I had been a unwilling participant of that system since 1972. When I got clean, I still had something like, I don't know, 8 or 9 more years of supervision on the whole thing. 1984, I got a letter from a Pierce County Superior Court judge. I got a letter from a Grays Harbor Superior Court judge. I got a letter from a Pacific County Superior Court judge. I was pretty famous. What they said was, I was no longer a threat to the community. And they released me from my probation. When I opened those letters and saw that, I said, what a gift to Narcotics Anonymous. What a gift to Narcotics Anonymous. Because you people did for me what I couldn't do. I was destined to die in the institutions. I believe that. The institutions did one thing for me. They slowed me down. Some. The other reservation I had was if my mom died, I couldn't handle it, that I'd go get loaded. 1984, my mom suffered from lupus, and she had a real difficult time in that. And I didn't even know I had that reservation until I saw how sick she had become. And when I did that, you know, I said, no, God bless her, yeah. My mom has had the privilege of seeing me clean for 5 years at this time. No, I will continue with that respect. She would always want me clean. And work through that thing. May 30th, 1989, my mom died. I have a picture of her up here at the podium with me. Thursday, when I came here and I looked at the program schedule and saw my name on the program schedule, I said, my God, how proud my mom would be of me today. And she is. This picture that I have here, my mother got cancer. It was a real fast-acting cancer. She's got a bald head. She's got a bald head in this picture. And the picture shows her almost childlike, where she has this sense of peace. And that is probably one of the nicest moments, because that day that I was visiting her, she let me rub her bald head. You know? Mom and I got to spend the last 28 days that she was alive with her. What a gift. I understand today that it's our parents' responsibility to help our children into this world. I know today it's our responsibility to help our parents out. Yeah. I also know that death doesn't mean the end of a relationship. I love her more today than when she was alive. She is with me. I was able to write the eulogy for her funeral. And one of the sentences that was in there was, one of Virginia's biggest hardships was watching her son spend 22 years in active addiction. And one of her biggest joys was watching him spend 7.5 years in Narcotics Anonymous. Yeah. I had to, let me go back, during that 27 days she lived at my house. I took her back and forth for treatments. They had her on Dilaudis. I had to monitor mom's medication. And the gift of this program was I didn't get drug hunger. I didn't get thoughts of using mom's drugs. It was difficult seeing mom under the effects of that drug. But it was okay because she wasn't hurting. And that's the biggest thing that I wanted for her was, don't hurt, Mom. Please don't hurt. You know, and she used to say during that last month, don't worry, be happy. You know, like that wacko song that they had, you know? And I thought Mom was just sort of placating me. You know, just sort of discounting my feelings. I realized the night that she died, what she meant by don't worry, be happy. Yeah. And I think there's a few people in the audience that know what I mean by that. She had made her peace. She had done everything she needed to go. And she could leave. The last week, she was in the hospital. My stepfather came to me. And I mean, if we can ever pick a stereotypical Archie Bunker, God bless Everett, he's one. Yeah, he's got the crew cut from 1951, and he's kept it that short ever since. I'll never forget riding in dump trucks with him and him trying to run over freaks. You know, freaks. And here I am, like the last time, I got my first haircut in 1980. Yeah, and I got the last one before that in 1964. So I had this little ponytail type stuff. But Everett came to me and he said, your mom is real bad because she was in intensive care. He says, we have worked the last 27 years to build some comfort, and I don't want to lose that. Neither does your mom. But we have to protect our monies. So what that man did was he took me to the attorney's office, and he put a very large sum of money in my name. And I believe that's a real statement about what this fellowship is. Because remember, in 1977, I took everything I could away from that man. And here he was, trusting me over his own son with their life savings. Yeah. Because this program does give us consistency, it gives us respectability, and it gives us honesty and intimacy with others. The last day my mom was alive, the nurse came to me and said, your mother's vitals are real bad. And if she goes to code, what do you want us to do? And I had to make that decision. Because we had talked about that. And she says, please don't ever do it. If it is my time, let me die with dignity. I had to trust, and I had to follow through with that commitment to her. During that 7 days she was in the hospital, I had a tablet. My mom was coherent, incoherent. There were times where she would yell and scream at me and say, "Why are you keeping me locked up in this room?" And I got to understand how family members go through when they see us in our disease. Yeah. And how I was able to just love her for who she was, not what she was doing at that time. I had to go ask the nurses and doctors to strap her down. I had to take her to the bathroom. But what a gift. What a gift. Because I know how I would have done that being a drug addict in active addiction. I wouldn't have been there. The last day she was alive, as I used to pray with my mom, even though in my consciousness she couldn't hear me, I believed that she could, though. And I told her, I said, "Mom, I need to go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And why I'm gone, if you need the time to die within your own time, please do that." And I went to a meeting in Grace Harbor, in Aberdeen. There was probably 60 people there. I walked in, and there was many, many people that knew me, and they held me, and they loved me. And when they closed that meeting, that whole meeting prayed for my mom. That whole meeting prayed for me, and that whole meeting prayed for my family. I went back up after that meeting, and she had died 10 minutes prior. I was able to clean her up, comb her hair, and say my goodbyes. And what a privilege. What a privilege. I've had a hard time with grief. Some of you have seen me around here. And you know what I've learned about that? My grief is equal to how much I love her. Yeah. Shortly after my mom died, I made a decision to separate from my wife. We have been separated close to 11 months now. One of the commitments that I did do in that relationship was, I am not willing to get sick with you. And I'm not willing to get sick, nor do I want you to get sick with me. I think one of the things that happened when we got married, and you know that marriage was the longest relationship I've ever had in my life. That marriage was based on spiritual principles 85% of the way through. We never did call each other names, nor intentionally hurt one another. And those were some of our beginning commitments. But I made the decision that we were two different people, that I loved her as a friend, and my God, I do. She is a wonderful woman, but not as a wife. So we've done the separation. And I want to say this, because you heard me say I had 12 relationships the first 3 years. I had this major one with this woman. If you have a relationship with somebody in Narcotics Anonymous, be prepared to look at them the rest of your recovery. Yeah. 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 So be careful. Be careful and don't act on impulse. I don't want to be lecturing. That's experience. That's experience. One of the things that I told her 5 months ago was, one of the things I took pride in was never hurting you, never having any amends to make to you. But I did have to make amends to her because I was being dishonest and not telling her that I wanted to divorce. So I told her that I wanted to divorce. I can walk away from that marriage and feel and know, I want to repeat, know, that I know how to have healthy relationships, that marriage was a success, and feel real privileged that we did what we did. God bless her. Neither one of us wanted to come together and have pain caused by our relationship. She is in a lot of pain right now and has not been to our fellowship for a while. Two Fridays ago I got my divorce papers. And the first NA member that was over to my house that day, I started talking to him and I called her the C word. And once again got that sense of shame because she doesn't deserve that, nor do I deserve to say that to another human being. And why I was able to make amends to God, that man, and myself right after I said that. Her pain right now will pass. I know she has a fellowship in Narcotics Anonymous. I have to stay close. I want to say something about the 10th and the 11th and the 12th step, because I'm going to move on to that. The 10th step has been invaluable. If I wouldn't have started doing the 10th step when I first got clean, I would have been in trouble. The 10th step has helped me clear the wreckage of today up. I talked about it 3 years doing that first, looking at all the wreckage that happened in recovery. If I do a good 10th step, I don't have to build new stuff. One of the things that's happened with the 11th step was I've done some written work in there because I didn't know much about spiritual principles. And one of the things I know our basic text says is spiritual principles are never in conflict. I love that sentence. And so what I've done for a written 11th step is write out the spiritual principles that have been in my life that day and give my thanks to God and spending some time to allow Him to give me some more. Some of the things that I've had from the 12th step, it says we had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I've never had any burning bushes. I've never had any of these great big lightning bolts. But I have spiritual awakenings listening to one addict sharing with another, reinforcing how this program works. I have spiritual awakenings when I see addicts in pain and they keep coming back and they stay clean. I was given the privilege of being the first convicted felon in the state of Washington to being a sponsor, a Narcotics Anonymous sponsor at the Walla Walla Penitentiary. What a gift. What a gift. Because we're literally changing the world. That prison system said addicts are addicts. They finally said, well, let's set some other addicts in. And there's a couple of addicts in this room that went to that penitentiary here about 3-4 years ago, and I just looked at one and God, I love him. It was tough. It was tough. Because part of us got faced with what we had to do to survive. One of the things that happened was I got this vacation in the state of Arkansas in 1971 and 72. That's a tough place. Third day I was in that penitentiary, I was raped, was stabbed and cut. That didn't come out until I had done a four step. But that really affected who I was as a man. It still affects me today, that fear of I'm going to get violated. I was in a dentist chair, and I had that same sense of panic that came that same day, and I literally relived it. And I says, Dr. Adams, I just need to tell you this, but I'm going to dump this on your shoes. This is what happened in 1971. I lay in this chair, and I'm ready to rip your lips off. So please turn me around so I can see the door and you, and I will be fine. I don't have to hide anymore. Yeah, I don't have to feel different. I don't have to feel less than. I have a home group. In that home group, all the men are here except one, and he couldn't be here. And what a privilege. What a privilege. I have so many friends today. So many people that love me. And I think that's the gift of this fellowship. Because it literally took me 6.5 years to start figuring out what there was to love within me. But once I got rid of those, got out of that sixth step from hell, and started getting away with them defects, started cleaning up that shame in that eighth and ninth step, you know, I started to feel more of a part of America. I work for a large corporation. Most of them don't know I'm an addict. You know, I continue to like to say, people don't have to know unless I tell them. I have this one friend up in Olympia, Washington. He's a pharmacist. He don't know I'm an addict either. But that's just my little sense of, that's my little joke with God and me. I appreciate the care. I appreciate the love. I appreciate the compassion. Because without you, I wouldn't be here today. I want to thank you for helping me recover one more day. Thank you.